Tom Metzger, Terabatani, come on down. You're the host of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in north central Indiana, right next to Terabatani's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terabatani's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the Insurgent, or just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
Well, here I is, back in a bunker, Terrible Tommy right here, and it is a cool day. It's getting colder, too. Overcast and sort of crappy out there. Well, I got busy today, and I had to do some honeydew stuff, working on a water softener. I never had a water softener in my life, and suddenly I've gotten one. A buddy of mine gave me one, so I'm fiddling around with it, trying to get it going. And so I think we're going to have a little pre-recorded show on here today to take up the slack. Yeah. But I'll tell you, all the work I had to do with this thing, I'd been probably money ahead just to gone out and bought a new one. Yeah, right. You ever do have that problem? You're always wanting to save money and cut corners and do stuff like that. And it always comes back to sort of bite you in the ass, or most of the time. I don't know whether this was a misspeak or what, but on the BBC this morning I heard that 12 countries were bombing Syria. That sounds almost impossible, but I don't know how they could get them all in the air at one time. 12 countries bombing Syria? There's going to be nothing left of that place. I also heard that there's 2 million Black Africans entering the job market in Nigeria each year. And I thought my ears might have been screwing me up there. 2 million in one country? Maybe they meant it all Africa. But I don't know about that. Because their oil price is going down there in Nigeria, and they got problems. They got big problems. If you got 2 million blacks trying to vie for a few jobs, there are going to be a lot of problems down there in Nigeria, baby. And down in South Africa, the head of the country, the Presidente, well, they got him on the ropes for stealing money out of the treasury. He spent $23 million on his ranch. $23 million on his ranch. And so they're a little upset with him down there in South Africa, all the other Negroes.
Jews. The fear of being attacked is ever present in a community repeatedly targeted by Islamist militants. Whether it be Mohammed Merah gunning down small children at a Jewish school or Amedi Coulibaly shooting dead shoppers at a Jewish supermarket. As a result, record numbers of French Jews are taking up Benjamin Netanyahu's offer and seeking sanctuary in Israel. Well, the Israeli ambassador to France is Aliza Bin Noon, and she joins us now. Thank you, Ambassador, for taking the time to come to Euronews.
Thank you for the invitation. Thank you.
You took over the job in Paris 5-6 months ago now.
Yes.
How does it feel to be Israel's top diplomat in a country where soldiers are posted outside synagogues and where people are being physically attacked and even killed just for being Jewish?
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to be in France as an ambassador, the first woman ambassador. For me, it's really a dream, you know, that it's coming true. Of course, it's not a good feeling to see soldiers everywhere and to see people, you know, being very concerned and feeling insecure. But for us, you know, being Israeli, it's not a new situation. Unfortunately, we're used to that. About the last events, of course, it's very saddening that 2-3 months after I arrived, suddenly we witnessed this horrible terror attack in France.
In Paris, 130 people were killed. Your husband was nearly caught up in that violence, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, he was on the way to the stadium, and luckily enough, you know, he had the change of plan in the last minute. But I was really shocked because I was at home, and I was watching Homeland, you know, an episode in Homeland, and when the news broke out, the first moment, I didn't know if this is part of the film or part of the story, or is it reality? Unfortunately, it was a very sad reality.
There's this debate, you'll be well aware of, going on within the Jewish community after the attack of a Jewish teacher with a machete. And now French Jews are asking themselves, all these years after the Holocaust, whether they should hide their faith in public, whether they should stop wearing the traditional skull cap, the kippah, for their own safety. What do you make of that?
Look, this is a very personal, of course, decision, and there are I think it's up to each and everyone to decide whether he wants to wear a kippah or he doesn't. But I think it's very sad, either way, that people, the Jewish people, have even to think about this issue, that they have to think whether they would take the risk or not take the risk. The French government is doing its utmost to provide security for the Jewish community. They have policemen and soldiers deployed, you know, in schools, in kindergartens, in near the synagogues. So I think that we really appreciate very much the efforts that the French government is doing in that respect.
Given this context, the offer made by your Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to welcome French Jews with open arms has more resonance than ever. Many thousands have already made the move to Israel. Would you recommend more do so?
Again, I think that the decision to make Aliyah to Israel is a very personal decision, and this is up to each and every Jew to decide where he wants to live. Israel is, of course, is a Jewish state. Israel is welcoming all the Jews that want to come to live in Israel because this is, you know, the only Jewish country in the world. But I think, again, that the fact that Jews would like to go to Israel because they don't feel safe or because they're afraid, it's not the way. This should not be the reason.
You previously served as Israel's ambassador in Hungary.
True.
And anti-Semitism has been a problem there since the war. That was a particularly poignant posting for you, wasn't it?
It was, because I'm from Hungarian origin, and my grandparents, they were executed in the Holocaust. My father was also a Holocaust survivor. So this was actually the country where from where my grandparents were deported to Auschwitz. And it was a very difficult personal experience for me. Therefore, for me, it is very important to do everything that is possible in order to fight anti-Semitism, to encourage, you know, education in that respect.
It's worth pointing out that France is home to both the biggest Jewish and Muslim populations in Europe.
Yes.
And while anti-Semitic acts last year topped 800, the number of Islamophobic acts tripled to around 400. Do you think the two communities are doing enough to come together and to stand united against all this hatred?
I think they are doing a lot. I think the inter-religious dialogue does exist, you know, here and elsewhere. I think maybe more should be done. And it's very important for the societies to get to know each other and to live together and to cooperate together against threats, against hate, against anti-Semitism, against Islamophobia, against people who really, they fight against democracies and human rights.
You're unhappy at the moment, Israel, about the EU's decision to label products from the Israeli settlements. But given that most of the world considers Israeli settlement activity to be illegal, why shouldn't European consumers have the choice as to what they're buying?
Because I think that it's not fair to discriminate Israel on that regard. There are more than 200 disputes, territorial disputes in the world, and the EU decided to focus on Israel and on Judea and Samaria. I think that the conflict that we have with the Palestinians is known, and the only way to try and solve it is to sit down around the negotiation table and discuss the fact that the Palestinians are refusing to come, and our Prime Minister called them on several occasions in the last months, shows that there is no a real will to do that. And the fact is that Mahmoud Abbas, he received a strategic decision 2-3 years ago when he decided to go via the international community to exert pressure on Israel, hoping that by cornering Israel, he will see the concessions by the Israeli government. Unfortunately, Israelis are not abiding by pressure, and we showed it in the past where we were ready to make territorial concessions with Egypt, with Jordan, but it had to be because the population, the Israelis, saw that the other side is coming in good faith. When the other side is not perceived as coming in good faith, then the chance of concessions is really not very high.
Obviously, that's a particularly Israeli way of looking at things, and Palestinians would take a very different view and say that it was down to Israeli inflexibility that peace talks are not progressing. Just finally, I know relations with Sweden have been particularly difficult between Israel and Sweden since Sweden recognized Palestinian statehood. And now the Swedish foreign minister wants an independent investigation into the killing of over 150 Palestinians amid the recent spate of stabbing attacks against Israelis. What's wrong with that? Why shouldn't we look into whether Israeli security forces could have shown more restraint?
Because I think it's outrageous. I think that the aspiration or the desire to come and invest, to interfere into internal affairs, something that is not happening nowhere in Europe, I think it's outrageous.
No matter what's going on in Israel, the world doesn't have a right to...
No, everybody has the right to everything, but I mean, there is a limit to which, you know, one picks on Israel being a democratic country who is really fighting for its democratic values. It's the only country, the only democratic country in the Middle East. The context into which we have to look at things is very, very worrying. The situation in the Middle East is deteriorating. Israel is surrounded by enemies, and to come and to start asking Israel or demanding from Israel to open up to an international investigation because, you know, there is no trust or not enough belief in our democratic system, I think it's an insult. Really, it's an insult.
Really interesting to talk to you, Elisa Ben Noon, Israel's ambassador to France.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you very much.
So now all the Jews over there in France are beginning to move to Israel, and people from all over Europe, Jews are moving to Israel. Now look, that country is very, very small. I think it's about the size of Rhode Island. I'm not sure. But I'll tell you one thing. In the tour bus, we went around it in one day. I mean, that's pretty short time to go around a country. Their jet planes can't even turn around over in the skies over Israel. Anyhow, and they're bringing other people in. They're bringing black Jews in, so-called black Jews. And now they got thousands of blacks coming in from sub-Sahara, and they're putting them in concentration camps down in southern Israel. So it's going to be lots of fun over there. Even though it's a modern, up-to-date country, in the cities and everything, I can't see it going forever. Can't see it lasted too long. Well, let's go back to 2009. Yeah, 2009. This is a show we did back in 2009. We'll go back there and roam around a little bit. Thank you.
tell you what it means. This means war.
This time of the month is the dead turkey. But really, I'm not a great turkey fan. I can eat a little turkey, but I prefer good southern fried chicken myself, but also a steak or other kinds of meat. So anyhow, we didn't go out and kill no turkey. I know a lot of turkeys around this country that I wouldn't mind killing, but something keeps holding me back. Slow down, boy. Slow down. You know, I get these little thoughts in my head, and I carry them around for sometimes a day or so. I like to share them with you. I was just thinking, because I see things on TV a lot, and, you know, I hear them on the news that put a little thing in my brain, you know, we're as lone wolves. We need to remain as lone wolves, because I'm of the opinion, and I've heard that from other areas, including liberals, that are quite concerned that in the event of an uprising in this country, I know they feel that they may be targets, and for obvious reasons, and not necessarily honestly so, because there's a lot of progressives out there that I have a lot of agreements with. I got a feeling after the first couple of weeks of any internal struggle in this country, there may be a lot of progressives and a lot of us having a lot more agreement than we do now. But I'll tell you one place that really scares me, well, it doesn't scare me, but I'm very concerned about it, that we don't run out and try to join in with these Christian right-wing groups that are based in Christianity. Because I'm of the opinion that when they get their hackles up and they get their fanaticism going, that they could very quickly turn on you and me, especially if we're not Christians and various things like that. And so what I'm telling you, in the event of an explosion in this country, a whole lot of these, especially here in the heartland and the Bible Belt, of these people, they're going to be forming up militias, but I don't think you're going to feel too safe running with them. In fact, you may be making a big mistake by trying to run with them. So you're going to have to keep your lone wolf status and observe from afar what's going on before you would commit to anything other than your own personal survival, and maybe a few other lone wolves around the, you know, wherever you're at. So I think there'd be an inclination to run right out and say, the guy says, well, I hate the Niggers. Let's go get the Niggers. You might be inclined to join up with them, but you may find that when they find that you don't agree with them on religion and things, that they may turn on you as fast as patted you on the back. I don't trust a lot of these people as far as I can throw them, so I'm passing those thoughts on to you. You can accept them or say, Tommy, you're full of condensed bullshit, and that's all right, but at least it's in the back of your brain. I've seen films and so forth where guerrilla fighters are of one stripe or another in the woods, and two or three of them that are all lone wolf types, and they'll see these guys coming through the woods, and they'll assume they're on their side, and they run out there, brother, brother, and they shoot them down. So that's what I'm talking about. Without further ado, let's go to Wolf DC, who I think agrees with us on that very much.
In battle, you kept your wits about you. Don't relax that caution now. The Nazi party may be gone, but Nazi thinking, Nazi training, and Nazi trickery remain. The German lust for conquest is not dead. It's merely gone undercover. Somewhere in this Germany are the SS guards, the Schutzstaffel, the Gestapo gangsters. Out of uniform, you won't know them, but they'll know you. Somewhere in this Germany are stormtroopers by the thousands. Out of sight, part of the mob, but still watching you and hating you. Somewhere in this Germany, there are 2 million ex-Nazi officials. Out of power, but still in there. And thinking. Thinking about next time. Remember that only yesterday, every business, every profession was part of Hitler's system. The doctors, technicians, clockmakers, postmen, farmers, housekeepers, toy makers, barbers, cooks, dock workers. Practically every German was part of the Nazi network. Guard particularly against this group. These are the most dangerous. German youth. Children when the Nazi Party came into power. They know no other system than the one that poisoned their minds. They're soaked in it. Trained to win by cheating. Trained to pick on the weak. They've read no free speech. Read no free press. They were brought up on straight propaganda. Products of the worst educational crime in the entire history of the world. Practically everything you believe in, they have been trained to hate and destroy. They believe they were born to be masters. That we are inferiors, designed to be their slaves.
You need to start thinking about using OPSEC. You need to understand that your personal information, your unit's information, information about the mission, and how you handle that information is valuable to the bad guy. Find out who your OPSEC officer is. Pay attention to what your OPSEC officer has to say. Listen and learn. Act as true today as it was back in the old days. Loose-lipped sink ships. Catch your pie hole.
One other thing. To read something from this speech. Our son Track is 19, and 1 week from tomorrow, September 11th, he'll deploy to Iraq with the Army infantry in the service of his country. No one's questioning the valor or the sacrifice involved in that. But as was pointed out by the liberal veterans organization, VoteVets.org, generally, disclosing the date of deployment of troops into a war zone is against OPSEC, operational security procedures, and is, in fact, in some circumstances, illegal. The location in Iraq to which Track Palin is supposed to be going had, in fact, been leaked to some right-wing blogs, the exact location, and that clearly is a violation of OPSEC.
Get your pie hole!
Leading manufacturer of ammunition, Steelhawk Incorporated, announced a massive recall today of jacketed hollow point bullets, which may not properly shred the internal organs of victims. When functioning normally, the tip of a hollow point bullet shatters into fragments, then cuts a wide and jagged path through the tissue and bone of its target. But due to a factory error, nearly 100,000 bullets with solid points were shipped to retail stores, resulting in a greatly reduced capability to explode flesh. Steelhawk CEO John Cullen announced the recall at a press conference this morning.
In Steelhawk, nothing is more important to us than the complete satisfaction of our customers when they maim or kill. Some of these defective bullets can leave an exit wound as small as a plum. That is unacceptable.
According to information released by Steelhawk, the first notice about the defective bullets came from a man who shot and killed his brother during an altercation at a county fair and was disappointed that the victim's face remained, quote, more or less intact. Frank Ehrman was among the hundreds of other dissatisfied customers.
You know, you spend good money for a hollow point bullet, you expect it to explode ahead in a geyser of blood and brains. You know, if I wanted to kill someone without destroying the body, I'd use a hammer.
To address complaints like these, the company is also offering discount coupons for its newest product, Inferno Bullets, which start a small fire inside of someone when you shoot them.
We understand that when our customers shoot a man, they want to see his liquefied organs pour out of every hole in his body. Give us another chance. We'll give you the lung-shreddingest bullets on the market.
Still, the effort might not be enough for many customers.
Those people over at Steelhawk ought to be shot in the face in front of their families.
Many gun owners have said the recall has been so frustrating they will no longer use bullets, returning to more low-tech methods like beating victims with spiked clubs or dragging them behind their cars. Moving on, Congress announced today the long-debated Darfur aid package will be used for a Darfur memorial instead.
White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance calling. This is the White Aryan Resistance, and I'm your guest host, DC Lone Wolf. Today we'll be talking about operational security. We should all take the advice given earlier in the show that keep your pie holes shut. Apparently Palin can't keep her pie holes shut, so keep that in mind. OPSEC is a two-way street. Everyone needs to be aware of it. It can work for us, so we need to keep our ears open all the time and find out what the enemy's doing, and we need to, at the same time, make sure we are practicing good OPSEC, staying quiet. But today I want to first get out of the way the beeper question from Tom's request a couple shows ago. Well, yes, you can still get a pager, and you won't find them in stores as much. Go to ghetto areas. Maybe crack dealers tend to use them here and there, but you can get them from superpager.net. There's a lot of places for them. I haven't really price checked them. It's $50 for the pager, and it's $5 a month for the service. They've got some real tangible benefits to using these pagers. They tend to force you to use prepaid phones and other phones. What phone you use keeps changing as what's available moves, and it prevents feds and other entities from having one easy phone to tap. So instead of one, they may have to get three or four. That is very useful. There's another thing I want to mention. Prepaid phone cards are quite useful. Sometimes they filter out your caller ID information. That depends on the provider, and it's not something you should count on, but it's a nice little extra. What it really does is it keeps your phone record sanitized. When AT&T looks at your phone bill, they'll say, oh, he called 1-800-SPRINT 30 times this month, right? Well, naturally, when you use one of these prepaid phone cards, even though you're using it at home, you'll go ahead and call an 800 number, and that's all they're going to see on your bill. So they'll see the calls, and they'll be more or less censored. They'll have to call up AT&T, and, they'll have to call up your company. Let's say you're using a Sprint card and ask Sprint, well, what numbers did this particular prepaid phone card call? And you have to put it together after the fact. Some people go so far as to use one prepaid card per person and, you know, use different companies. You can get these things at places like 7-Eleven and change them up real quick. You can get small denominations for the cards, and that way you keep changing the numbers on them. But what you're really looking to defeat is the pen register. And it's before you get a full-blown wiretap, a judge will say, okay, well, here's the list of who the guy called. Show me that he called a bunch of mob bosses or something useful, and maybe I'll give you a full-blown wiretap order. Well, in those situations, now this is before they're actually looking at you, they want to go back in time. They want to see, well, now this guy came up on our radar, I'd like to see his last 6 months worth of phone calls. That's the time it's useful. If you're being looked at now and you've got a full-blown wiretap, using that service is not useful, but it shields what you did beforehand. So keep in mind that that can be very useful, and these pen registers don't show what they call post-dialed digits. And there was some sort of legal case about them a year ago, 2 years ago, something somewhat recently, and they were saying that somebody might dial in their social security number or PIN numbers and things like that. So the side effect of this is that short of a full wiretap order, I believe that digits after the phone number has been dialed, you know, press 1 for this, press 2 for that, those are all private. Naturally, you can't rely on this sort of protection to save your ass, but keep in mind that may be a stumbling block for Zog. So that's the only thing I wanted to get out of the way ahead of time. And remember, pagers promote the use of payphones, and that's an inherently good security practice. Pagers are truly passive and cannot reveal your location, provided you're using the one-way pager. Pagers act by broadcasting your message to everyone. If you have nationwide service, literally the communique is delivered to all towers everywhere, and it's repeated. Intercepting and decoding pager traffic is actually quite easy. There's programs on the internet that will help you do it. Keep that in mind. They're not exactly super secure, but they they're just like one of those one-way voice links. People that read off numbers list. If you listen to shortwave communication, you'll eventually hear somebody reading off this. Attention, attention, attention. And you'll hear that for about 2 minutes, and then you'll hear somebody saying, uno, nueve, dos, dos, cinco, and they'll go ahead and read out massive lists of numbers. Well, what you're probably listening to, if it's the one that starts, attention, 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 that's actually drug trafficking. So what they do is they have a message, they broadcast it out, somebody's got a little code book in their pocket, they go ahead and subtract the numbers in their code book, it's called a one-time pad, from the numbers they wrote down from the radio, and they convert it back to letters, and then they have their message. Those systems are actually really secure, super big pain in the ass to do, but shortwave communication allows anyone to talk anywhere. The receiver, since that is completely passive, has no worries. As long as it doesn't look weird for you to have a shortwave receiver, you're okay. And in countries other than the United States, especially Latin countries, their local radio service isn't exactly top-notch, and they tend to use shortwave radio communication, which has that wonderful side effect of being able to listen around the globe, pretty much from anywhere. Another thing I want to mention is that law enforcement, what they do is they clone a pager, and it will, you know, the pager sits there and listens to all these messages, and it only brings up ones with the correct, you know, number on the sending a packet of information, and if it's to that number, it'll go ahead and show it, but it's actually listening all the time. Law enforcement has a clone version, and they'll get real-time intercepts to listen to whatever it is somebody's sending in. Another thing I really liked about pagers was that people tend to use codes for routine messages. For example, somebody would put in 111 as the code, you know, when a pager would ring off, and, you know, that meant something. That meant, you know, mom's calling you, or, you know, some sort of preset message. It could be anything. But I do like the idea that people are sending numerically coded messages that have no obvious connection to what they are, and if somebody's intercepting these messages, well, they've got to figure out what 3-1s mean, or 3-3s. You know, people could send these routine messages all the time, and that's really good comsec. And you take it to the next level by having, you know, the traditional code books that change on, let's say, a weekly basis, monthly basis, or whatever. I was watching this show. It was very interesting. These crack dealers, I think it was called The Wire. Yeah, that's right, The Wire. It was an HBO show. And they would message each other numbers to call. And they had a way of scrambling the numbers they were putting in. It took the cops quite a while to figure out the system they were using. So let's say somebody was going to make a phone call, and they were going to dial a number, let's say 202-555-1212. Well, go ahead and get out a phone. Somewhere in your house there's a phone. Look at the number pad, okay? Now, instead of dialing 2, you jump the 5 and you dial 8. And then you're going to dial the 0 for the 202, and you substitute that for 5. So you see how the number 5 is in the middle of all your keys, okay? And the only thing that 5 substitutes for is 0, okay? So if you've got a 0, it's a 5. If it's a 5, it's a 0. So you just got to jump the 5, right? So, okay, we're going to dial 202, so that's 8, 5, 8, right? That's 202. And then we're going to do 555, which would be 000. And instead of dialing a 1, it would be a 9, okay, because we have to go through the 5. Okay, and then when we dial the 2, we've got to go through the 5, so it's 8, 9, 8. And as simple as that little coding style is, it was able to give law enforcement trouble for a good while. Now, I don't propose these sort of systems as secure, but to the casual observer, it's a pain. Naturally, pre-coded messages like 4437, okay, that showed up on the pager. Well, what does that mean? Well, there's no way to tell. You can get code books that were used for Morse code days when it was expensive to send these telegrams. They had whole books that you can convert a couple numbers into a full-blown message. And you can look at one of those and sort of imitate it. Naturally, you'll have to make it your own, and then good security practices determine that you discard that after a while. But from here on out, we're going to talk about traffic analysis, and I think it's more important than people realize. Even when communications are encrypted and you can't actually read and understand what's being said, you've got to keep some of these things in mind. A lot of information can be gathered even though you can't understand what's being said. And this goes for us also when intercepting digital communications that we cannot actually understand. There's some things you can learn. Here are some simple things you can start doing. One, you can make some rule-based determinations here. I've got frequent communications can denote planning. Rapid short communications can denote negotiations. A lack of communication can indicate a lack of activity or the completion of a finalized plan. Frequent communication to specific stations from a central station can highlight the chain of command. Who talks to who can indicate which stations are, quote, in charge or the, quote, control station of a particular network. This further implies something about the personnel associated with each station. Who talks when? This can indicate which stations are active in connection with events, which implies something about the information being passed and perhaps something about the personnel or access of those associated with certain stations. Who changes from station to station or medium to medium can indicate movement or fear of interception. You can keep changing frequencies, whole bands. For a while you could talk on VHF and then switch completely to UHF and then maybe even down to CB if you're paranoid about keeping moving. Call signs and addresses are frequently encrypted, requiring assistance in identifying them. Okay. Traffic volume can often be a sign of an addressee's importance, giving hints to pending objectives or movements to crypt analysis. Traffic flow security, okay, is the use of measures that conceal the presence and properties of valid messages on a network to prevent traffic analysis. This can be done by operational procedures or by protecting the resulting information from features inherent in some cryptographic equipment. Techniques include changing radio call signs frequently, encryption of a message's sending and receiving addresses, code address messages, causing the circuit to appear busy at all times, or much of the time, by sending dummy traffic, sending a continuous encrypted signal, whether or not traffic is being transmitted. This is also called masking or link encryption. I've got a funny story there. At one time, the Americans had a link that they went to lengths to seemingly protect, that it contained important information. Well, they actually had it hooked up to a static generator box, and no information at all was being put through. All kinds of resources were wasted on garbage. Like, oh, this new top-secret algorithm, if we could only decode it. And they spent all kinds of time and treasure on it. And it's BS. It's nonsense. Just imagine if you're wanting to waste Zog's resources, call up random people and give them coded messages, and it's all a bunch of shit. Or you could use things that sounded like code words in innocent conversations, and you can make other people look bad, or look like they're involved in something or not. But yeah, you can have fun with these guys putting out disinformation. We can't forget this disinformation. Churchill said, information is so important, it should always be guarded by it should always have protection from bodyguards of lies, or something to that effect. By sending out continuous messages, let's say you expected to make, I don't know, a call once a day or twice a day from a track phone, and you're concerned about traffic analysis. You can make, say, 4 calls a day, and you can keep the amount of traffic leaving this track phone to be seemingly the same. Let's say you always make 4 messages. They could be at any time during the day, let's say. But it always has to be 4, and that's kind of the rule. And when you've got nothing to transmit, well, you put out 4 dummy messages. When you need to talk to one person, which one message and 3 dummies, 2 people, 2 people, 2 dummy messages. But the traffic always seems the same. So even though something's being planned, people are organizing, things are happening, moving and shaking, well, your communications seem constant. You might even take this to the point of, having the call go for a certain length of time. If you were passing coded messages to somebody, you could just call in dummy numbers. Just pull some numbers out of your brain and or some random letters, and then time will be wasted on crypt analysis when there is none. And boy, will these guys go nuts trying to break this code when there is no code. Just imagine, the first block or two of information would be a signal that this is a dummy message, throw it in the trash. Put it in the circular file. And by having a very discreet way of, you know, flagging a message as garbage that you know, no outsider would know, you can make them really go on a wild goose chase. I do concede the point that this may make you look like some sort of nut or somebody to watch, but if your purpose is to waste time and resources, well, I mean, there's no disputing that that would be effective. Okay, during the planning and rehearsal for an attack on Pearl Harbor, very little traffic passed by radio, subject to interception. The ship's units and command involved were all in Japan and in touch by phone, courier, signal lamp, or even flags. None of the traffic was intercepted and could not be analyzed. In the other show, Tom mentions he really likes wiring networks. Well, I've got to agree that tends to be a good thing. There's very little chance of interception if you've got a hard line from point A to point B, especially if it doesn't use the conventional phone network. You know, it would involve a break-in to tap this line anyway. I mean, let's say you're in a small neighborhood and you ran a pair of phone wire from one house to the other, and you had some sort of little hotline that was point A to point B, totally off the grid. Well, those sort of lines are highly secure, and somebody would have to find out about it somehow and then come up and manually tap it, and that's not exactly likely to happen. In an electronics class at college, we put voltage on just a pair of phones and a pair of standard phone cable, and we had a power supply that was able to create ring voltage, and we could hit a button to buzz somebody, make their phone ring, and then you could talk. And it was strictly a point A to point B intercom system, but these sort of private phone lines can exist, and in certain circumstances, may be smart ways to communicate. I remember back in the late Cold War in the 80s, people were talking on laser links. Point A to B, you would have to catch a laser beam, and the idea was that's hard as hell to get in the middle of a laser beam. In fact, if you get in the middle of it, well, you kind of stop the laser beam. So those were used, IR links and laser. That was an 80s thing. And that provides an extremely directional signal. As always, if you're using walkie-talkies, communicate on the lowest power you are able to. One, it saves your battery, and two, it minimizes the number of people that can grab your signal. If practical, which is probably not, you can go ahead and use directional antennas, but on a handheld walkie-talkie and man-portable equipment, I think everyone's going to be using omnidirectional, so I don't see that as being practical, but, I mean, you know, if you wanted to go the extra mile, yeah, you could do that. Admiral Nagumo's Pearl Harbor attack force sailed under radio silence with its radios physically locked. It's unclear if this deceived the U.S. Pacific Fleet Intelligence. They were unable to locate the carrier in the days immediately preceding the attack on Pearl Harbor. Operation Quicksilver was part of the British plan for the invasion of Normandy, World War II. It fed German intelligence a combination of true and false information about troop deployments in Britain, causing the Germans to deduce an order of battle which suggested an invasion at Pas de Calais instead of Normandy. Fictitious divisions created for this deception were supplied with real radio units, which maintained a flow of messages consistent with the deception. Well, it's important to know if for some reason you believe you're being listened to, or you know that you are, you can feed bogus information. And you can really sell a cover identity if you know people are looking, and you can really make sure that, you know, there's no wild talk going on. I want to make sure that everybody remembers that these phones aren't safe. Just want to say it again. You know, I was reading this this one book. It says put little stickers on your phone that says this is this line is tapped. And the idea is that you never know if it was, because a lot of people think they hear clicking and popping and static and nonsense. Well, if law enforcement's doing it, none of that's going to happen. They just tell the phone company, hey, AT&T, tap that line. and it's totally digital. The ESS, electronic switching system, used by the phone company, turns this phone line into digital data, into these packets, and they'll just duplicate the packets. There's no degradation of line quality. Now, if you got some sort of PI trying to illegally wiretap you and literally physically working with analog lines, okay, maybe I'll give you that. But almost anybody you're worried about, you can't tell. There are some gizmos that go on your phone. They detect voltage and resistance changes, those sort of things. They got the place, but you should really be using encrypted lines, and if you're not doing that, then it's face-to-face. And I will concede to Tom, yeah, there's some things that you just don't trust technology to at all. You know, if you're talking about something real wild, you know, it's a handshake and a pat down and an okay, let's jump in the pool up to our necks, and then we can talk. You know, for some things, that you know, there has to be a face-to-face element. And these organizations like Al-Qaeda, they're being high-tech by being low-tech. They realize that these networks are, you know, relatively insecure, and if you get a little flash card, you know, SD memory chips, you know, you can put, you know, 4 gigabytes of information on this, all right? It's almost like a microfilm was in the 70s, right? You could have something as small as a period that can contain a page of information, you know, or photographs, all kinds of, you know, big-time stuff. And it was a big deal to be able to make those and handle them. Well, now if you just mail one of these really small chips, in fact, they've got ones even smaller than those SD cards, it holds a gig and it fits into a carrier that's the size of an SD card. And, I mean, they're getting this information so small, you know, you can just send this by snail mail. You know, all right, it'll take a little time to get there, but you can give code books, you can give manuals, send messages. I mean, you can do all kinds of stuff with this. So you can have the advantage of encryption, and you can also use that as almost like a fail-safe. If you're relying on your encryption to protect you, you've done something wrong. Encryption, in that sort of situation, it's the last line of defense. And, you know, things look suspicious, I'll give you that. You know, if they find all this stuff, it's encrypted. But that means you didn't do your job in the first place. What are they doing having found it at all? I'm taking the position of recommending people use laptops because they are small and portable. Encrypt them with 2 layers. Some people might say that's overkill, but I know there's a lot of people perpetually worried about where's the back door. Well, it's unlikely that there's a back door at all. And if there is a back door, well, it's unlikely that there's 2 back doors. And another thing is, even when U.S. intelligence was able to listen to Japanese purple and red codes, well, we let a lot of operations kind of slide because we could never admit that we could break the codes. If somebody found out that feds could break PGP, it would be huge news. And real terrorists, I'm talking Hezbollah and those kind of guys, would stop using it, and you're not that valuable. They will allow evidence to go by the wayside and make sure they don't use it just to protect the fact that they can, in fact, break PGP encryption or something like that. So even when they can break it, they're going to be reluctant as hell to admit, oh, and how did you do that, by the way? Show us the evidence.
Well, we don't want to do that.
You know, so you've got a certain amount of protection merely in that. So, yeah, and lock these laptops up. And also get an external hard disk, right, USB 2.0, and go ahead and put another operating system on this external hard disk. Go into your CMOS settings. Change your machine so that it will actually boot off of the external hard disk. And then you'll have a whole other operating system, all your classified data. You can have it encrypted. And then if somebody finds the machine as is, without the extra hard drive, there's nothing special about it. But when they find the other hard disk and, you know, plug it in and like that, then you've got the classified machine. So you can keep 2 sets going. And they've got a hard drive called the Western Digital Passport. That's about the size of a checkbook. And it runs at 7200 RPM. USB 4.0, so that's 480 megabits a second communication speed on the device. Works pretty well. I've never had any kind of problem with it. I don't see why anyone can't use that as one of their private machines or something like that. And it gives you the fun little extra of being able to play with Unix-type systems without replacing Windows. And there's a lot of fun things you can do with external hard drives. You guys should play with it, if only to play with Linux or something like that. That's a lot of fun if you're a computer nerd. Would like to be one. But back to the traffic analysis. It's difficult to defeat traffic analysis without encrypting both messages and masking the channel. When no messages are being sent, the channel can be masked by sending dummy traffic, similar to encrypted traffic, keeping bandwidth usage constant. There's a program called Waste. I haven't looked at it in a while. It's designed for file sharing and some things like that. I do remember it was one of the rare programs that would actually send out junk data to defeat traffic analysis. It was encrypted, an encrypted channel, but they would always keep it constant, and that's something militaries generally do. But it would be great if that became a little bit more common as ISPs install more and more bandwidth by putting down these fiber optic lines, Fios, and like that. That can really make that a real solution. Let's see. When no messages are being sent, it can't be masked. It's very hard to find information about the size or the timing of the message. The known solutions require Alice to send a continuous stream of messages at the maximum bandwidth she will ever use. This is acceptable for military applications, but not for civilian. That is about the size of it. Traffic analysis is actually very hard to do. And that's all the material I have on the traffic analysis. I've got some other tech tips on keeping some of your equipment private. Let's see. Hiding a computer. Okay. Guys, go out and take a look at the Mac Mini. Okay? It's a full-blown computer, so small, it could literally fit in a lunchbox with lots of room left over. Okay? Now, go find yourself a VCR at Goodwill. Alright? Now, go ahead and get the VCR, or at least get rid of the components that are in the way. Okay? So, this is going to be a non-functioning VCR by the time you're done with it. But, go ahead and rip all the parts out. Now, you take this little Mac Mini. Okay? It's 6 inches squared. Very, very small. You can go ahead and put that in the VCR casing, right? And you'll line up the CD DVD drive, alright, with the spot where you'd fit in a VHS tape, and go ahead and get a little tiny extension cable that comes with the machine. Dremel out a hole in the back of the VCR case and try to make it look a little bit professional. You can hook up this little extension cord so that you can plug in a regular monitor. And in this case, what you're going to use is a flat-screen TV. Okay, so you've got a legitimate-looking TV hooked up to a VCR. Now, unless somebody really looks at the connector and figures out, hey, wait a minute, VCRs don't use DVI connectors or Super VGA. This is not a high-res thing. What is that? Okay, unless somebody really gets into it, then they're going to figure it out. Okay, so now you've got a way to put your CDs and DVDs in, alright? You literally put them right through the VHS thing. If you take the outside casing of the Mac Mini off, it's got a white housing, well, guess what? It looks like a bunch of electronics, and circuit boards, because, that's what's inside of all these things, right? But you epoxy it down to the base of the dummy VCR, okay? So when somebody looks in there and they open up the little thing, believe it or not, it looks like it looks like the VCR is unaltered, like you would shove a tape in there. And if somebody actually tried to put a tape in there, they just figured the damn thing was broken. Alright, now, you use that, and you put a lot of camouflage around it. Let me tell you what I mean. You're going to get, let's say, one of those CD players, the component type, right? So you've got an amplifier there, and then you've got a mixer, and then you've got a regular maybe a radio thing in there. And then you've got, you know, I don't know, some other turntable. I mean, just get as the bulkiest system you can come up with, put wires all over the place, make them all black, a real rat's nest, wind them up, get shit hooked into other shit, and by the time you've got this VCR in there, it looks totally legitimate, okay? You've got a nice sound system for your PC, and it goes right up to your flat screen TV. I mean, you got the cable box in it, it's all together, alright? This gives you a lot of camouflage to the fact that there's a PC hidden in there. And, guess what? You're gonna say, well, how am I gonna plug in the keyboard? Where's the mouse? You can go wireless. And just think, you can use something like Bluetooth, short range, communication. I think they're encoded somehow. I doubt the, I don't know if I would go as far as to actually call it legitimate encryption. I think it's just encoded. But, you know, it's low power anyway, and the whole object is stealth. And if you're staying entirely Mac with this, you can get this really small keyboard that that's very thin, all right? And you just hide that and the mouse, and you're rocking and rolling. Now, you're probably going to want to install a single-pull, single-throw switch, okay? That's just a regular on-off switch, where the on-off switch on the Mac Mini used to be, right? Put a pair of leads on it, and then put that on the back of the VCR, so when you flip a little switch or touch a button in the back of the VCR, or wire up one of the buttons that's already there on it, so that, you know, you can go ahead and turn it off and on. Really, all you have to do is turn it on. But I found something even better than the switch. I recommend drilling maybe a very small hole, just getting a loop of copper out, right? And you got one loop on the top for one side of the circuit, another loop on the other side of the circuit. And remember, this doesn't have to be a continuous connection. If you just sparked it together, almost like you're going to jump start a car, it would turn the machine on, and it will stay on. So you put these two little contacts close together, right? I want to say like an eighth of an inch apart, quarter inch, it's something real short, right? You take, let's say you're wearing a wedding ring, something gold. Well, hey, that's a connector, isn't it? And there's no real voltage to speak of here. So if you get it so that you can short it, you can use a key, literally just a piece of metal laying around, that you short these wires together for just a half a second, and then this machine turns on. And then you use the computer itself to click on the, you know, the Apple button, and then shut down, and the machine will turn itself off. You just have to turn it on. So you don't even have to have real working switches, you know, to speak of. Just these two wires that you can short somehow. And it's very easy to do. So you guys should really give a lot of thought to this, hiding in plain sight. You know, even when cops go and search places, they might break something apart. But if all they see are circuit boards, they're not going to know what the hell they're looking at. And this Mac Mini is so compact, it fits in whole. Just take the top case off, so that it looks very electronic-y, you know. And these cops, they're a bunch of asshole idiots. They won't know a disguised machine when they see one if you've done your part and you strip off all the labels. Maybe if you've got some sort of really obvious, you know, Intel inside chip there, put an extra heat sink on it, or do something to, you know, rip all the stickers off, camouflage it, put heat sinks on things that don't need heat sinks just to cover up any brand name marking. But you can really camouflage this thing. And if you're that worried about your system and you want to have good access to it, you may consider that as a real solution. With the Mac Mini, you've got so much room. You put the power supply in the VCR also, and have the tail coming, you know, right out like it was the real power supply for the VCR. And you know, remember, you put it in with all this other console equipment and like stuff, you know, you put it in the middle of this, you know, shit sandwich with the wires going everywhere, nobody's going to fuck with it. They're going to look at it for 2 seconds and say, okay, that's the guy's TV and stereo system, and it's going to keep on walking, and then, you know, ripping your couch apart and stuff like that. So you guys keep that in mind. Now, I've got another minor tip. I don't know how important this would be. Consider removing the CMOS battery so that time and date stamps are not really useful. I doubt anybody really needs to worry about that. But I thought I'd throw it out there. If you pull the battery on, you know, most systems, it's just going to read the BIOS first date of manufacture. You know, it might read like January 1, 2005 or whenever the CMOS was made, you know, on the motherboard. So, I don't know, that's something I throw up there. Computer guy can comment on that. Let me know what you guys think of this. But I really want everyone to be mobile. And I want everyone to have the mentality of shoot and scoot. Just like it was in the Afghan conflict versus the Soviet Union. Afghan rebels had, rocket launchers, and they would shoot and run their ass off. The Soviet forces would look at the smoke trail and say, okay, let's go bomb the hell out of that position. And, you know, they'd mortar it, they'd strafe it, you know, whatever. If somebody sat around for a second shot, he didn't have a very long life expectancy. So, fundamentally consider that, and that's why I want everyone to have mobile technology. I really like laptops. Nice thing about them is you can literally lock them up when they're not in use in safes. You can put them in hiding places. You can take it out of an area quick. Let's say you've only got a minute to grab your shit and go. A laptop can be pulled very quickly, and you can hide it. You can keep it in the trunk of your car, down where the spare tire slot is, you know, something like that. If that, you know, really means something to you, if you want to hide the equipment. I've never had a need for it, but you know, everyone has different needs, so that's something to keep in mind. Well, ladies and germs, here's an interesting little factoid I thought I'd throw in there. There's a device inside of a plane called a transponder, and you can set various codes to tell radar operators on the ground know exactly where you are, and it identifies your plane. Well, if you set it to 7500, or if you say over the radio, squawk 7500, in either case, you're telling aircraft control, you're telling them, I have been hijacked. Please send police. And another secret little tidbit is that taxiing with your flaps down, okay, the flaps on the wing, if you leave them down for an extended period of time, longer than, you know, even would be considered you being lazy, is another discreet signal that you are being hijacked. Now, it's much less formal than sending out 7500 on the radio or on your transponder. Aircraft control will actually hail you, and they'll say, confirming squawk 7500, and if you don't confirm or don't deny, that's taken as a sign that you are, in fact, being hijacked. And a couple of pilots, small pilots, have made that mistake of flipping through the transponder and landing on 7500, if only for a little while. That is a good way to find yourself surrounded by state troopers when you land your aircraft. So I just wanted to put out that little tidbit. I'd also like to make some comments on this mission planning matrix I'm pulling out of the SAS Fighting Techniques Handbook. Mission planning matrix for maritime affairs. It discusses the method, maximum one-way range, maximum sustaining speed, the amount of equipment you can carry, the secrecy afforded. Okay. A small boat, limited only by amount of fuel, approximately 1.7 to 6.8 kilometers per gallon, depending on load, can usually have a sustained maximum speed of 21. I assume this is all in... Yeah, this is in miles. At max load with motor, 2.3 at max load with paddles, up to 2,500 pounds total weight per boat. Secrecy afforded is port of fair, special training minimal. Underwater scuba, 0.93 miles open circuit, 1.9 miles closed circuit. 0.3 miles when towing a bundle. Maximum sustained speed is 3.7 to 4.3 miles without equipment. Individual equipment is limited to one bundle per person. Secrecy afforded is excellent. And the training required is extensive. Surface swimming, 6.2 miles without a bundle. maximum sustained speed, 4.3 to 5 miles an hour without equipment. Individual equipment when taken is one bundle per person with good secrecy, special training required minimal. And as reading here, the book discusses Zodiacs, and there are a couple problems with them. They're able to move quickly. However, the boats are very noisy, and they offer a high-profile radar silhouette. If the engine fails, they're very, very slow and hard to maneuver. Apparently, a very common insertion vehicle is the canoe. It has no disadvantages other than it's only as good as you are. It's limited to a certain extent by its size and the stamina of its two-man crew. You can get a two-man kayak. And for lone wolves, you can get a one-man kayak. And they provide extremely low radar signature. You can get fiberglass canoes. They're entirely non-metallic. Depending on what equipment you take, you can have literally no metal in this entire kayak. Because the boat itself is fiberglass, you can get a wood paddle with a rubber or plastic fittings on it, and depending on what equipment you're carrying, that can be non-metallic also. I mean, hey, you could fill that thing up with dynamite matches, and that wouldn't have any metal in it. So that's very interesting from a secrecy standpoint. It turns out that swimmers and people using scuba gear, using these closed circuit rebreathers, are limited to 2 atmospheres, and I think that's going to be about 30 feet. Yeah, that's a depth of 30 feet. These systems run on pure oxygen and a 12.7 cubic foot cylinder, that's the apparently the industry standard, will last for 4 hours through a rebreather. They're using pure oxygen, and divers traditionally carry magnetic limpet mines. Mines weigh about 30 pounds, usually constructed of neutrally buoyant plastic, or they're carried in a buoyancy bag or air bladder, which makes the load weightless. And the higher you are in the water, the harder it is to detect you, because there's a certain amount of chop at the surface, normal traffic moving in and out. So finding divers, swimmers, at the top is actually a bit difficult. Finally, I'd like to close out today's show with a little discussion on safe houses. And I'm going to take this from that same SAS Fighting Techniques Handbook. The following advice on maintaining safe houses is condensed from a section entitled Advice to Freedom Fighters from a KGB manual. 1. The agent should set up his own safe house under an assumed identity. The house should not be overlooked, and ideally the agent can enter and leave unobtrusively using a number of routes. It is easy for surveillance teams to watch a single road or choke point, such as lanes, bridges, or crossroads. Unlike operational houses, safe houses may be less conspicuous in densely populated urban areas, particularly those with transient populations. Kilburn, a suburb in northwest London with a large transient Irish population, has been a favorite base for the PIRA, active service units operating in southern counties of England. They buy furnished rooms in university towns, and they provide an agent with a cover and constant source of short lease accommodations. 2. False identity cards should be registered with the police only as a last resort. Identity documents or business cards showing the address of the safe house should never be carried in case the agent is arrested in the street. Rent and bills are settled in cash to avoid leaving traceable tabs, such as checks and credit card accounts. 3. The agent's lifestyle should mirror his declared profession. A traveling salesman may be away for long periods. A doctor may be expected to make late-night calls, while students or the self-employed work from home. 4. Maintain friendly but distant relations with neighbors and landlords. In the event of arrests, These people can provide useful information to policemen or security officers. 5. All clandestine materials must be stored in a remote but secure facility such as a locked garage rented by a third person. 6. Meetings may be held at the safe house, but its security declines with the number of people who come to learn of its existence. Parties and other innocent social functions can be used to mask the comings and goings of agents and get the neighbors accustomed to the appearance of strangers. Meetings should never appear suspicious by continuance of the night. One group of agents printing propaganda leaflets at night were mistaken by their landlords for currency forgers, and the late-night visitors to another Soviet safe house were thought to be patronizing a whorehouse. Most importantly, other agents should never stay overnight. Suspects' homes are often raided in the early hours of the morning, and the police can net two agents for the price of one. 7. Security. If the safe house has been set up to provide temporary accommodations for a number of agents, each must be able to gain access without drawing attention to themselves. A PIRA car thief was shot while trying to steal a car parked outside. It transpired that an armed terrorist was sleeping inside at the time. The police then found the active service unit's weapons and explosives in an attached garage. In this event, the orderly running, maintenance, and security of the safe house are the responsibility of the safe housekeeper. This individual ensures that the premises are regularly cleared of incriminating evidence, and that an additional key is held by a third party who clears and closes the safe house in the event of arrest. The lone agent, or a safe housekeeper, also institutes a series of signals, such as chalk marks on a lamp or lamp post, to show that the safe house is occupied or empty, secure or compromised. In this way, other agents are prevented from walking into a trap set by security forces. Ironically, the increase in terrorist activity throughout the Western Europe has made the task of setting up a safe house far more difficult. Safe houses have been identified by the various security measures taken to protect them. In 1979, the German Security Service received information that a Red Army faction safe house was operating in Frankfurt, working on the assumption that terrorists would not risk having their financial transactions recorded by using checks or credit cards. The security service approached the city electricity authority and obtained the names of 18,000 customers who paid their bills in cash. These were fed into a computer and cross-referenced with the financial records obtained from companies and government departments. After extensive cross-checking, the computer identified only two individuals who settled all their bills in cash. A background check revealed that both were using false names. Their properties were both raided. One of the houses was being used by a drug dealer. The other was an RAF safe house, where Rolf Heisler, a terrorist on the wanted list, was hiding. Well, if they could do that in the late 70s, I'm sure they can do that today. In fact, I would make sure I use a few money orders, maybe a few cashier's checks, and pay in cash, and possibly a prepaid credit card here and there, to confuse anyone trying to figure out whether I was living a cash-only lifestyle. And cashier's checks, well, that's paying with a check, and I don't think anyone would look at you funny if you handed them one, and that still respects your privacy. Money orders, of course, respect your privacy. There's the cash itself, and at many malls, they're offering these Visa gift cards that are good anywhere, and you can register them online with your name. And much like a track phone, I assumed everyone sort of knew this from the get-go, but yeah, wherever you activate this credit card, wherever you activate a track phone, you know, these prepaid phones, that is logged, recorded, and kept in a file. So please, please, people, activate these things in libraries. Both the credit cards and the track phones can be activated via the internet. You can register the cards in advance, put any name you want. For example, SimonGiftCard.com is a source for instant cards up to $500. You can even have some of them pre-printed with your name. They're not rechargeable, and they don't require any identifying information to be checked out. You can go in and put no name on it. You can give a phony name. You pay in cash, up to $500, non-rechargeable. And you don't have to declare any information. If you have a rechargeable card, however, then I think the Patriot Act really starts to kick in. They're going to want social security numbers and that kind of nonsense. You can lie to them, and that works for, like, the Green Dot cards. which are prepaid debit cards that request a social security number, but you can give them a fake one. And apparently other people have used it and have gotten away with it. So keep that in mind. Don't always pay in cash continuously. I talked to a stockbroker before, and he said paying only in money orders over and over and over can eventually look suspicious. So every once in a while I throw in another form of payment. They won't accept cash, so I just throw in a cashier's check, and they write down that it was paid with a check in their records, and no one really seems to think, well, wait a minute, was his information really on the check? Or paid with a check from somebody else? But yet the great thing to do is to rent a room in one of those college towns, pre-furnished. You won't have to pay any utility bills. The stuff's already there. You can come and go as you please. If you're going to take Gorilla's man's advice and become active in a state other than your own, go one state over and scout that area out, feel comfortable there. Go ahead and rent a room from somebody. Say you're moving in and out of town, you're here bidding on a government contract, something like that. That would give a reason for you to be here only sometimes and say, well, it could be for a long period of time, it's cheaper than a hotel, I'd like something that's kind of homey, and the person will be thrilled that you're not there often, that you're paying rent, and that you're paying cash, so obviously it's not going to bounce, and you're not a deadbeat. So they'll be thrilled to be receiving cash. They'll be thrilled to be paying in cash, because now no one has your information. Give them a phony name to start. Pay cash right up front. I doubt anyone will want to see your ID. Maybe a fake out-of-state ID would do the trick if anybody really wanted to ask a lot of questions. possibly make up some sort of fake company ID card. People wear those around a lanyard, and people think, oh, that must be right. It's got your name right on it, and it says the contractor you work for. And the thing can be as phony as a $3 bill, and nobody's going to be any wiser. So consider that. A fake ID that is actually pretty flimsy, but you put it right around your neck, and anybody looking at it would certainly be fooled. It doesn't even have to look completely realistic. It could just be a figment of your imagination. Go on the internet. You can find some places that'll make cards up, look at some of their samples, and just substitute the name for some identity that you're trying to create. And go ahead and rent one of those things using that cover story. That, I'm here bidding on a contract, I'm in and out. And, you've got a completely untraceable place. Come and go as you please. And trading them in for another is quite easy. And you can maybe agree to rent the place for 3 months here and there. And the tenants will be quite happy that they're receiving money and you're not around all that much. So keep those sort of things in mind. And we're going to close up the show. Think white, act white, be white. Bye bye.
Well, another good Wolf DC show. He's always got good information on there, and we're fortunate before he went on hiatus to get several shows out of him, and hopefully they'll last until he gets back in the saddle again. So anyhow, that was a good show, and we'll see you on Moonsday. Well, that's a little long, and the quality is not so hot, but hopefully you'll get enough good out of it. Now, some of that information is passé now. Technology has passed it by, but there's a lot of good information there, and I hope you enjoy it. So this is Terrible Tommy, and I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day, Lone Wolf, She-Wolf Day in the bunker. Okay, righto. And remember, always, I have nothing to say, sir. Have a good day.